Hello, I'm Sam Fisher. This is number 0874, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0874. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Matt Whitten, who has written several scripts for television series and also several novels. His latest novel, set in the future, is called 51%, where companies actually own the rights to human beings.
When the corporations have you 51% owned, then they're allowed by law and they're allowed to tell you what to do. And they're also allowed to put chips in you that can see anywhere that you are. They have a GPA, so they know your location at all times. And they even, in this novel, they want to have more power. They want to be able to test your drug levels to make sure you're not taking drugs. And they want to make sure you are taking some drugs because they want people who are docile in some ways. And so they will actually force them to take drugs. 51% is when the corporations have that power over people.
Author MJ Preston is back on the show with his latest book called Wendigo Plague.
I took a true crime that occurred in the Fort Saskatchewan area in 1879. It is a true story of Swift Runner, a Cree trapper who worked for the Northwest Mounted Police and the Hudson's Bay Company, who murdered and cannibalized his entire family. He was the first man hanged in Fort Saskatchewan. So what I did is I took a true story with real characters from history, injected fictional characters, and wrapped a horror novel around it.
Science writer Andrew Bezekas, the night sky guy, returns talking about whether or not life on Earth actually began on Mars.
That is a question that we've been asking for so long, and we're continually trying to find out. And there's this new study that's raising a fascinating possibility that could basically tiny life forms actually survive being blasted off the side of Mars, like if there was an asteroid impact, and could that life form eventually arrive on Earth?
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, dad joke theater, Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, morning shower thoughts, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0874, was Sam Fisher, who is the chef sommelier at Walter Hospitality and a longtime Stuff File program listener. Thank you very much, Sam, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Those of you who listen to the show on a weekly basis, here's a complete coincidence. On last week's show, I had a punchline where I mentioned the television series Knight Rider. And this week, I actually have a story that deals with Knight Rider.
I am the voice of Knight Industry 2000's microprocessor. K-I-T-T for easy reference. A Kit, if you prefer.
A black Pontiac Trans Am replica of Kit from the 1980s TV series received a New York City speeding ticket despite sitting motionless in the Volo Museum in Illinois for years. The car features the same Knight license plate as the show's talking computer vehicle. Said museum marketing director Jim Voidilla, the fact that we're legally tied to a movie prop is interesting. We have no idea how we got registered from a ticket in New York to the plates in California to the Volo Museum in Illinois.
Doing a comparative analysis of license plates can be very involved, sometimes as far back as the factory where the car was made.
The museum has requested a hearing to challenge the ticket. New York operates 750 speed cameras that automatically ticket vehicles exceeding the limit by more than 10 miles per hour. The museum is embracing the mystery, posting on Facebook, "Does anyone have Hasselhoff's number? He owes us $50.
I hate to be the one to break this to you, but automobiles are not human. They have no lineage or personality.
I wonder why I keep forgetting that.
Well, I'm sure Hasselhoff still has some Baywatch money, or some euros from his pop star in Germany days. Organizers for the 2032 Olympics in Brisbane, Australia, say they're not considering alternatives for the planned rowing venue, the Rockhampton Waterway on the Fitzroy River. It's a well-known crocodile habitat. Former Olympic rowing champion Drew Ginn says the varying currents could give rowers placed in a particular lane an unfair advantage, but after official testing, Queensland state lawmaker Matt Canavan said, "This river is flat as a tack. I mean, if Jesus Christ came back to this world, it's a great place for him to come because it's flat enough to walk on." Okay. The crocodiles don't seem to be of a concern. Several schools and a local club already use the waterway for elite training. Wow. Schools use this place for rowing training? Do they take attendance before or after the training? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, French authorities in Saône-et-Loire are alerting motorists about drunk deer creating road hazards after consuming fermented fruits. Police shared social media footage showing a deer behaving erratically, running in circles after apparently eating intoxicated substances. Officials stated, "Not all road users are sober," in their warning post. Wildlife becomes inebriated after eating buds, fermented fruit, or decaying plants, resulting in totally unpredictable behavior, according to authorities. Drivers should watch for sudden crossing, inconsistent trajectory, immobilization on the road, and disorderly escape from affected animals. Police advise caution, noting, if Bambi overindulges on the forest aperitif, it might not be the time to drive like you own the road. Well, speaking of Bambi, I believe the correct term is Twitter-pated.
What's the matter with them?
Why are they acting that way?
Why, don't you know? They're Twitter-pated.
And let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Matt Whitten has written 7 novels, 4 mysteries, and 3 thrillers. He's also written for TV on shows like Law & Order, House, Pretty Little Liars, and Supernatural, to name a few. His new speculative thriller is called 51%. Matt joins us from upstate New York via Riverside.com. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Great to be here.
Great to have you on the program with us. You also teach as well. As someone who writes and teaches about writing, how do the students work in this day and age when it comes to writing as opposed to the techniques that you had learned back in the day when you first started writing?
Well, I teach TV pilot writing, and I've seen a couple of amazing changes over the past 25 years that I've been teaching it. And one is that when people would come up with ideas for pilots 25 years ago, they would always be either cop pilots or they'd be doctor pilots, or, you know, occasionally they'd be some kind of relationshipy pilot. But there weren't that many different boxes, different categories people would write in. And now when people come up with stuff, you know, it's amazing. They'll come up, you know, with crazy sci-fi ideas that are, whatever, located underwater or in 3 different galaxies at the same time. Or they'll have a show that is like, you know, half of it's about a garbage man and half of it is about, an anesthesiologist. I mean, just everything is crazy. And it seems like they're just, you know, TV has exploded in the kinds of things that it pursues. And there are a lot of different, you know, possibilities people can do now. So I'd say that's one change I've seen. And the other change is just simply that now there are shows that don't have commercials. So you don't have to instruct them in the same way, or they don't have to work in the same way toward act breaks, specific for act breaks coming before commercials that they used to do back in the day. So those are the two main changes, and they both relate to TV opening up to all kinds of different things.
As someone who teaches, does teaching for you broaden your horizons in your own writing?
Oh, it's fabulous. I love seeing what the students are up to. And, you know, sometimes they'll be writing some pilot in some area I might know nothing about, or I've never watched that kind of show. For instance, I'm not a huge horror fan. So they might be writing a horror pilot. So, okay, I got to educate myself. I got to watch some horror shows. And I find that really interesting, things I would never have seen before. And now I have to think about how they could structure their pilot in the same way you would structure any pilot, but with the horror component. Or it might be a teenage romantic drama. And there again, I don't watch a lot of those on my own. So they get me to watch. So I like that. And, you know, I'm sure you have this too. Anytime you're working with especially younger people who are just excited about exploring a new thing, it just gets you jazzed up too.
Let's talk about your book. It's called The 51%. What is this speculative thriller about?
Well, it's set 20 years from now. I used to say it was set 30 years from now, but some things that have happened in the last year in the United States that make me think it's closer than it was. So this is a world where the big six corporations, they own just about everything. They own schools, they own parks, they own roads, they even have police departments. Like, it's not the NYPD anymore, it's the NYPD Incorporated. And they even own people. So a lot of people are 51% owned, because in this world, if you want to go to college or high school, there's no public colleges or high schools anymore. So you have to pay a corporation like 20% of your income for the next 10 years if you want to go to high school and college. And there's no, you know, Obamacare anymore. So if you want to get health insurance, God forbid you get cancer, you might have to give up another 20% or whatever of your income for another 10 years. And it happens to people that they wind up being 51% owned by the corporations, and then they're like indentured servants, and they have to do essentially what the corporation wants them to do. So this is the world. It's an extension of the world we have now, and I would say also as an extension of this world, we have people who are fighting back. The heroes of 51% are fighting back, and just like now, it's the people versus the corporations. And in every generation, good has to triumph over evil yet again, because there's a constant battle in our world. So that's what it's about. And the title is 51%. It's because a lot of people are 51% owned by the corporations.
Well, let's talk about the 51%. Why did you decide upon that particular figure? Why not 60? Why not 49? What is it about 51% that enhances this story?
Well, when the corporations have you 51% owned, then they're allowed by law and they're allowed to tell you what to do. And they're also allowed to put chips in you that can see anywhere that you are. They have a GPA, so they know your location at all times. And they even, in this novel, they want to have more power. They want to be able to test your drug levels to make sure you're not taking drugs. And they want to make sure you are taking some drugs, because they want people who are docile in some ways. And so they will actually force them to take drugs. So 51% is when the corporations have that power over people. Anywhere from 51% on higher, they have power. If you're 20% owned, you have to pay 20% of your income, but you're not controlled in the same way. So one of my characters, for instance, is 20% owned, and she just got pregnant, and she's afraid there might be a problem with the pregnancy that would require her to be owned, which would be bad for both her and her kid. People, you know, it's indentured servitude. You might only get owned for 7 years, but it's hard to get out of that. Once you're owed that much money, it's hard to get out from under.
You initially said that the story took place 30 years ahead, but now you feel it's 20 years ahead. This was all from your imagination, but are you thinking or worried about the fact that some of this that came out of your imagination would actually come true?
Yes, and I'm concerned that so much of it has come true already. A lot of time, the electricity wherever you live might be owned by private companies. The water might be owned by private companies. The prisons, or 10% of prisoners in the United States are housed in private prisons, which are terrible. The military has a lot of private people working for it. There's a move afoot, I'm sure you're familiar with, to privatize Social Security. The post office is in trouble because UPS and FedEx are taking over a lot of their responsibilities, which makes it much harder, for instance, for the post office's rural customers who are not serviced by private companies in the same way. So a lot of this is happening already. Even with police departments, by the way, you can have private police in charge of campuses, in charge of downtowns, in charge of housing projects. There are an amazing number of private police in this country. Depending how you define private police, there are twice as many private police as public police in this country. And in many cities, it's up to 5-1, private to public. So yes, I'm very worried about a lot of this. I think that there's obviously a place for private companies. That's very important. But we need a strong government, too, a government that can look out for our interests. And when it comes to the private companies, the big companies are getting bigger and more powerful. OpenAI is getting more powerful. And a guy like Musk might be a trillionaire one of these days. That's very possible. And he gave, I think, $250 million to the most recent political campaign in 2024. So yes, I'm very concerned about it, and it does seem to be already happening that the rich oligarchs and the rich companies are getting more and more power at the expense of ordinary people.
I mentioned in the introduction that you've written 7 novels, but I also mentioned that you do a lot of television. What's the difference in the two mediums when it comes to writing? I'm guessing that television scripts is more like a sprint and novels are more like a marathon. Would I be accurate in that assessment?
You would definitely be accurate. If you're writing an episode of an ongoing TV show, you might meet with the other writers for about 2 weeks, come up with a story, come up with an outline, and then you might write the script itself in 2 weeks. So the entire episode from beginning to end might be written in a month. But if you're a novelist and you can write a novel in a month, some people do, but it's much more average to write a novel in let's say a year. So it's definitely a marathon and not a sprint. That's exactly right, for sure.
Does the hurry of writing a script actually enhance your novel skills when you're doing that?
Yeah, I'm sure it does. It makes me a faster writer, I'm sure. I've never thought about it, but that must be true. And you definitely, learn how to write to deadline, and you're not scared of deadlines. So I think it's a tremendous improvement in that way. Writing for TV certainly enhances your dialogue writing skills. And it also enhances your sense of structure and plot. Because, when you're writing for a TV show, people don't skim TV shows like they do books. They're looking at what's right in front of them. And if it's good, if it's holding their interest, they're watching it. And if not, they're turning it off or they're spending so much time on their phones that they're barely watching it. So it definitely gives you the feeling you got to keep it happening, got to keep it hopping. Every second counts. If you have that attitude when you're writing a novel, it helps too. I don't like having to skim novels. I don't think anybody does. So I really try to, as Elmore Leonard said, a novel is a life with all the boring parts taken out. So I really try to take that to heart and take out all the boring parts.
As a writer of television, when you write novels, do you write in a visual type of way?
Yes, I'm told that my novels are very visual, and I don't know that I do it consciously, but I think probably writing for TV and envisioning the scene has helped me do that. So yeah, I think it is a skill that TV writing helps with. TV writing helps with a lot of things. I would say the one thing TV writing doesn't help you so much with is writing the interiority of the characters, writing, what they're thinking, their inner monologue. And that's something that novel writing does better than TV. Or movies. So that's something that you really have to work on when you're shifting from TV writing to novel writing. Everything else, every other skill besides that sort of interiority, the interior monologue, I think TV writing does help with.
Would you like to see 51% on the screen, either big or small?
I would, definitely. Actually, I've been hired to co-write a TV adaptation of 51% for NBC. So that's been a lot of fun to work on. I should caution that that doesn't necessarily mean it'll make it onto air. I mean, NBC and all these networks order a lot more pilots to be written than ever make it onto the air. But it might. And I'm just having tremendous fun, you know, writing the pilot version. It's a real treat.
Well, congratulations on the book, 51%, and hopefully future congratulations to turning it into something on television. Thank you very, very much, Matt, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Matt Whitten, author of 51%. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0874, and you'll find links to Matt's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
How many dance instructors does it take to change a light bulb? 5, 6, 7, 8.
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
I'm a retired high school teacher, biology. I volunteer every week at our food bank. It's gratifying. Every once in a while, I run into a former student. We laugh and chat. Sometimes I meet their kids. I'm so glad I can still give them a little extra help when they need it.
The food bank is for anyone who needs one. Visit the food bank near you to help and be helped.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk once again to MJ Preston. He's an author. His new book is called Windigo Plague. Plus, Andrew Bezekas, the night sky guy, talks about life on Mars. We also have Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. But we've got much more in Stuff File News right here, right now. Finnish Air Force cadets face disciplinary action after using their flight patterns to create shapes resembling male genitalia in the sky during training exercises on April 13th. The Reserve Officer Pilot Corps participants were tracked by flight radar, which showed at least 4 aircraft following routes that made penis shapes. Air Force officials confirmed the pilots were disciplined for their actions. A spokesperson said, "The Air Force requires soldiers to follow good manners and rules of conduct, and if these are deviated from, it will be responded to in an appropriate manner." Officials emphasized no safety risks occurred during the incident. Well, I've seen the pictures of this. You have to admit, that's some pretty fancy flying. And speaking of flying, more than 70 participants from 15 countries gathered on May the 10th in Depan, Belgium, for the 6th annual European Seagull Screeching Championship. Here is what some of them actually sounded like. Contestants of all ages, many wearing seagull-themed costumes, competed in a local pub to produce the best imitation of the bird's distinctive shriek. Judges awarded up to 15 points for vocal accuracy and 5 points for performance. The event aims to improve seagulls' public image, which organizer Claude Villart said are often viewed negatively. He also said,
make seagulls sexy again. Be positive about seagulls. When you are on a holiday, you always remember the waves of the sea and the calls of the seagulls.
Competitors performed solo or in groups while enthusiastic crowds cheered each screech attempt. It would be ironic if all that screeching actually annoyed the birds. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, regular listeners will note that we have an occasional segment called Idiots in Flight, with people doing somewhat idiotic things on passenger jets. But in fairness, I have to give equal time to other modes of travel. So here is the inaugural installment of Ship of Fools.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. This is your cruise director with today's update on the rough seas of passenger asininity on the Ship of Fools.
Two women were hit with federal assault citations following a physical altercation aboard the Carnival Spirit during its March return from the Bahamas. The incident began when Tanya Nelson approached Lisa Horace and her husband in an account settlement line, informing them they were standing in the wrong queue designed for Diamond and Platinum members. Tensions escalated when Nelson repeatedly touched Horace's husband's shoulder. Nelson threatened to slap Horace first, prompting Horace to slap Nelson in response. The fight intensified as Nelson attempted to kick Horace while crew members intervened, with Nelson claiming Horace jumped on her back. Carnival staff separated the women as several bystanders witnessed the confrontation. Investigators reviewed surveillance footage before issuing citations to both women who were previously strangers. You know, it's a good thing that people on ships no longer have to walk the plank.
And should you look closely enough, it might even be you will find yourself aboard the Ship of Fools.
And now, this.
The Stuff File presents Sir Dudley Piddley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe's Poetry Corner.
A cheerful old bear at the zoo could always find something to do. When it bored him, you know, to walk to and fro, he reversed it and walked fro and to.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We've had MJ Preston on the show before. He's an author who writes horror stories, and his latest one, his fifth, is called Windigo Plague. It's set in 1879 on the prairies. He joins us from Edmonton via riverside.com. Hi, MJ.
Hey, Peter. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us once again. Right off the bat, what is the title about? What is Windigo Plague?
Okay, so what I did is I took a true crime that occurred in the Fort Saskatchewan area in 1879, and basically it is the true story of Swift Runner, a Cree trapper who worked for the Northwest Mounted Police and the Hudson's Bay Company, who murdered and cannibalized his entire family. Now, this is a very well-known story, especially in connection to the Windigo, because Swift Runner claimed that he was possessed by a Windigo when he killed all the members of his family and then ate them. He was the first man hanged in Fort Saskatchewan. So what I did is I took a true story from history, with real characters from history, injected fictional characters and wrapped a horror novel around it.
We've had you on the program before, and I understand, I knew from the last time we spoke to you, that you were a trucker, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And you were an ice trucker.
I was, yeah. I was an ice trucker. I did three seasons up on the ice roads, yes.
So how did you gravitate to writing fiction, and particularly writing horror stories, from whence you came as a trucker?
Well, it goes back even further, because my first novel, which was actually a horror novel, I started writing back in the 80s when I was in the Canadian Armed Forces. And it kind of got shelved for about, I would say, about 15 years. And then just one day, at that time, I'd left the military and I'd moved into the trucking industry. I found the manuscript half finished and I pulled it out and I thought, what the heck, I'll give it a shot. By the time I published that first book called The Equinox, I went up to do the ice roads, and I was actually selling the book to other truckers on the ice roads. They were buying the book off me, as well as selling it on Amazon. And I just, from there, I decided, you know what, I'm going to write another book. And so now I'm up to book 5. And that's how I got here. A lot of it's, in the old days, I used to actually set the laptop on the steering wheel once I parked for the night or I was in a loading dock. I always managed my time that way, and that's, I still do that today.
Well, it's interesting because I was when I brought up ice trucking, first of all, when you were an ice trucker, did you work as a tandem or were you alone?
As I understand it now, it's changing a little bit because of technology. But when I ran, and I ran 2012, 2013, and 2016, you don't run alone. You run in a group, because if somebody breaks down, the temperatures can dip down into the minus 70s, and eventually, you know, I mean, you could freeze to death. So you always have to have a warm truck to go to. So you go in minimum groups of 2, but usually packets of 4.
I know that there are groups when it comes to ice trucking, but as for in the cab yourself, were you just alone in that cab?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. You're alone. So you've got a radio.
Well, the reason why I ask that is during the time while you're driving, I mean, you have to be in control of what you do and have to pay attention. But does your mind ever wander to the stories that you have been creating when you are doing?
Absolutely, yeah.
When you were doing that as a trucker?
Absolutely. And I still drive truck now. Like, I have a dedicated gig, so it's in and out every day. Absolutely. Sometimes I'll spend between 12 and 14 hours a day on the road, and you've got to fill that void. And what I do, a lot of times I'll use music, of course, to inspire, but I'm constantly thinking about writing. And, you know, now that technology's gotten a little better, I've been able to review my work while I'm driving by listening to it, because I'm able to use an app to read it aloud to me as I'm driving. So it's, yeah, I'm still paying attention to what I'm doing on the road, but it's the same thing. We're always constantly thinking about stuff when we're driving down the road, right? That ice cream we're going to have or whatever, right? So
when you wrote your first book, you said you were in the military. Was it again that situation where there's plenty of downtime or introspection that you had the opportunity to create stuff creatively as a writer?
It's a total time management time, because I'm a family, or I still am, but I had kids then, yet people to feed, take care of, house, all that stuff. So you carve out the time you can to write. And when I was in the field in the military, I carried a notepad with me. When I got into a camp where there might have been a typewriter, I'd track down the guy that owned the typewriter and bore it off him. And I've spent many a late hours in my spare time. And thank goodness I have a very understanding wife that way, because she's always given up a little bit of that time as well for me to, you know, keep working with my craft and keep writing.
With Wendigo Plague, again, as I said, is a story that's set in 1879. Do you often do historical fiction, or is this a one-off?
No, this is the first time I've done historical fiction. I've written a few stories with historical backdrops, and quite honestly, my crime thrillers, the Highwayman series with Foreign Highwayman, there's a lot of historical backdrop in those, and live characters. So it's not something completely new to me, but certainly transporting back to 1879, I had to learn about horses. I had to learn about the Northwest Mounted Police. The lucky thing about it is that I've been able to walk every one of the scenes because it's local to where I am. I'm actually dab smack in the middle of this whole case, where Swift Runner was working for the Northwest Mounted Police, how he got ejected back to Egg Lake, which is only a stone's throw from my house, and then he went north to Athabasca after he was banished from his own people's land because of, you know, Swift Runner had a real problem with alcohol, and it turned him mean. And that's why he got fired from the Northwest Mounted Police as a tracker, and that's why he got banished by the Cree, who were then settled in Egg Lake. And when they banished him, they throw your whole family out. They didn't just throw him out. They threw the whole family out. So he was degenerating because he was a psychopath. And, you know, for everything I read, he wasn't a victim or anything like that. His actions were brutal. And it was really interesting. It really was. And there's going to be two more novels to follow this, but they're not in that time frame. I'm going to do one in 1979 and another one in 2009 to follow this book. So, but it's also local and Canadian, right? And that I really wanted to do another Canadian story.
Where does the inspiration for your books come? Because as you say, you've got two more in the works. What was initially the inspiration for this current book, Windigo Plague? And also the other two that you're currently writing?
I don't know. It just comes. You know, I mean, sometimes you're walking along and you look at something and you think, hey. But in this regard, I knew about this case. And what had happened is I was writing another Highwayman book, and a bunch of stuff happened, including my wife getting sick at that time, that kind of put the stopper on that. And I finished the first draft of it. And I just decided, you know what, I'm going to switch gears. I'm going to put this away because there's a lot of baggage with this manuscript. I want to sit down and write a nice, juicy horror novel. And I started looking at the local lore and history. And we're Canadian, man. And you know what? Our sovereignty is being challenged right now from a couple of different directions. And I wanted to write a Canadian story. And I think this is a really good Canadian horror story, and I want people to read it.
You have now written 5 books. When you first started, did you ever anticipate the success that you would have with the first book and subsequent books after that?
Well, of course, when you're young, you always wish for that sort of thing. But by the time I wrote the first book, I really wrote the first book to finish it because it sat for 15 years. And I had no idea if I was going to write another book. It wasn't actually until I went to the ice roads and I started looking around and going, wow, this is a great backdrop for a novel. And then I got the idea for my second novel, Acadia Event. And since then, I'm going to keep writing until there's no more left in the gray matter to spit out onto the page. That's where I stand. But I've got about 4 projects on the go now that I'm looking at.
Well, congratulations on the current book. It's called Windigo Plague. And MJ, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Hey, Peter, you know what? It's always a pleasure. I'll come back anytime. You're great to hang with.
MJ Preston, author of Windigo Plague. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0874, and you'll find links to MJ's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Giving you something to think about. This is Morning Shower Thoughts.
I guess a gossip is someone who has a great sense of rumor.
Morning Shower Thoughts from The Stuff File program.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife by Michael Libling is not like any serial killer novel you've ever read before.
Go ahead. I dare you to figure it out before the chilling end.
Find out what it's like to be the offspring of a multiple murderer.
Locked in a room or locked in your mind, it's really all the same.
The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife by Michael Libling. Available everywhere you buy books.
Coming to you from Canada, a place where fighting is frowned upon, unless it's on an ice rink. This is the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy, is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky, and also National Geographic's Stargazer's Atlas, the Ultimate Guide to the Night Sky. And Andrew, I have a question for you. Did life on Earth actually begin on Mars?
That is a question that we've been asking for so long, and we're continually trying to find out. And there's this new study raising a fascinating possibility that could basically tiny life forms actually survive being blasted off the side of Mars? Like if there was an asteroid impact, and could that life form eventually arrive on Earth? There's this new study that looked at a very, very interesting kind of bacteria, a species that's called Deinocleus radiodurans. And I know that's a mouthful, and it's sometimes scientists that they actually nickname it Conan the Bacterium because it could literally survive radiation. This bacteria can survive freezing, it can survive dryness, and all kinds of other kind of really extreme conditions. And that's why a species like this is really what's termed generally an extremophile. What researchers did, they tested this very hardy bacteria, whether it could survive the intense pressures that's expected when, say, an asteroid impact blasts rocks off a planet like Mars. What they did is they sandwiched this bacteria between two metal plates, and they fired a projectile, like a bullet basically, at roughly, you know, nearly like 500 kilometers per hour. It basically subjected these little microbes to pressures that are unbelievable. Like they're what they're calling gigapascals. That's what they're measuring them. For comparison, the pressure at the deepest part of Earth's ocean is about 0.1 gigapascal, and they expose these bacteria to up to 3 gigapascals. So many times more than what the pressure is experienced at the most extreme depths of Earth's oceans. And so even the lowest experimental pressures they used was about 10 times greater. So just to put that into perspective. And the results were really surprising, Peter, because nearly all of these little microbes actually survive the impacts. About 60% survived even the highest pressures during these impact scenarios that they were testing. This was really surprising. They even saw increased activity involved in kind of like DNA repair, cell membrane maintenance. That was being supported. Basically, the end of this experiment shows that it does support, but doesn't really prove the idea of panspermia. This is where life can kind of travel between planets, right? Inside rocks, blasted into space by large impacts. Because Mars, after all, is a neighboring planet. It's on average about 100 million kilometers away. But it's really interesting that if there was life present on Mars in the distant past, could it have actually seeded life on us? And this experiment is kind of pushing the needle towards this idea. This experiment doesn't really say that we're Martians, right? But it makes the possibility less far-fetched, I guess, than when we look at early Earth and early Mars. They may have exchanged material, and not just rocks, but maybe even biology. So it's really exciting.
Let's look at it another way. If life came from Mars initially, why would there be no remnants, or why have we not found any remnants of life on Mars, even in a bacterial situation?
Well, right now, you know, what we've seen so far doesn't preclude that there hasn't been any, that there isn't any fossilized evidence. We just haven't found it yet. We haven't looked in the right places yet. Perhaps some of these organisms, because we're talking, you know, when we're talking about Mars being more Earth-like and having habitable conditions that would have been conducive to, say, even microbial life, we're talking 3 billion years ago. So we may have to dig very deep into the substrate of Mars to find even that fossilized evidence, or maybe even currently existing life, but they're just living very, very deep underground, and we haven't had that capability to look there yet.
Well, maybe this is one of the reasons why we should go to Mars. And speaking of that, NASA is testing a new ion engine to get to Mars.
Yeah, and one day this ion engine could actually help send astronauts to Mars. This is really exciting. NASA's always been in the business of looking at the technology we need to get to distant destinations, and can we do them faster, more efficiently? So NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory out in Pasadena, California, has tested what they're calling a lithium-fed magnetoplasma dynamic thruster, or short, they call it an MPD thruster. It's a type of electric propulsion system that uses very high electrical currents and magnetic fields that really pushes and accelerate a lithium plasma. The long-term goal of this is that they would like to beef up an engine like this and be able to produce long-term power on a deep space mission. So basically, the technology that they're testing here is really part of a bigger Mars idea of how do we move large cargo, say habitats, fuel, and, you know, obviously humans across very large distances between planets, and do it more efficiently. Currently, we've got chemical rockets that are really great for launch, and they're really great at giving quick bursts of power. But if we could sort of harness electric propulsion, it's a potentially better for long-haul transport once they're already in space. So we're not talking about replacing rocket boosters on the launch pad with something like this. We're talking about once we're in space, we can turn an engine like this on. It's not that powerful, but it can be on for literally days, weeks, or months, and we can go much faster with something like this. So, for instance, we have a similar engine already that's currently on a spacecraft called Psyche that goes and visits asteroids. They can eventually accelerate the spacecraft to speeds of really high speeds of up to 200,000 kilometers per hour. So the idea here is that if you are kind of have a propulsion system that gives power in a slow and steady manner, it's low thrust, but it's got this kind of, I guess, like this relentless acceleration. It can really get up to very high speeds. And that really makes a difference when you have destinations that are measured in hundreds of millions of kilometers. And when you're talking at Mars, even one of the closest planets, the average distance is about 100 million kilometers. If you're looking at more distant destinations, perhaps some of the moons of Jupiter, you know, we're talking upwards of 600 million kilometers away. So you would need something like this, an electric ion propulsion system that can just keep going, being left on for many, many weeks or months. That would make a huge difference, and we'd get to these destinations much faster.
Shouldn't we test this thing out on short-haul situations? Like, for instance, wouldn't it be a good idea to try this ion engine on going to the moon?
The problem with them is it's too close. To get the benefits of such an engine, you need to have it on for many, many days, weeks or months, really to get the benefit, to build up that speed. The moon is only 400,000 kilometers away, and currently it only takes about 2 to 3 days to get there one way. So by the time the engine, an ion engine like this, could really get going, we'd already be at the destination. We'd have to slow down. So it doesn't really make sense for such a nearby destination. But Mars or asteroids or even the outer solar system, this could really make a big shift in the whole idea of how we can get large cargo, including humans, to these very distant destinations. So you got to think of this as kind of like an ion plasma engine, as a deep space cruise engine. It starts gentle, and then it keeps on pushing for months. And in space, there's no air resistance. So that steady push really builds up tremendous speeds, but over time.
One quick question before we go, and that is, what is the duration, the time frame that it takes to get to Mars currently, and what would this shave off?
Right. So if currently right now with our conventional rocket propulsion systems, it takes about 6 to 9 months to get to Mars when our two planets are lined up appropriately, which happens about every 2 years. So you have to wait once every 2 years to be able to make that trip in 6 to 9 months. Otherwise, it's even longer. But if we use a lithium plasma thruster like this, what they call an MPD thruster that they're experimenting with, we can actually cut down, like even a human flight, imagine, down to maybe 3 months, 2 to 3 months potentially to get to. I mean, it's still a long trip, but that's you're shaving off, you know, you're doing it in less than half the time.
Well, you know, we've run out of time again. I still wanted to talk about Mars. I still wanted to talk about the NASA Curiosity rover and what it has been doing. And there are other things that I wanted to talk about. So can we go to Patreon?
Yeah, let's do it. It would be so much fun.
Okay, sir.
Clear skies.
Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0874. And you'll find links to Andrew's site to get your own personal autographed copy of his books. Patreon subscribers, you can hear more of Andrew as a Patreon reward extra, where we'll continue to discuss Mars, plus NASA's almost 50-year ongoing Voyager mission, NASA's DART asteroid crash and the surprising effect, and Blue Origin's used New Glenn rocket launch. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I've got more Stuff File news to share with you right here, right now. 22 Buddhist monks wearing traditional saffron robes were arrested at Sri Lanka's main airport on April 26th after customs officials discovered approximately 242 pounds of cannabis hidden in their luggage. The monks, mostly young trainees from temples across Sri Lanka, had returned from a 4-day Bangkok trip reportedly funded by a businessman. Well, as the song goes, one night in Bangkok makes a hard man humble. Each monk allegedly carried roughly 5 kilos of the drug, valued at $3.5 million in total, concealed behind false luggage panels. Customs authorities called it the airport's largest cannabis seizure ever. Local reports suggest 3 monks recruited the others, who believed they were transporting educational materials and treats for the school children. The alleged orchestrator, potentially connected to similar monk trips, was also arrested. All 22 monks appeared before a magistrate who ordered their detention for at least a week pending investigation. And all this time, we thought that monks were high on life. Yeah. A 28-year-old tourist faces charges for defacing Florence's 16th-century Neptune fountain after climbing the marble monument as part of a pre-wedding dare to touch the statue's genitals. Italian police say the woman caused minor but significant damage to the horse's legs that she stepped on and a frieze decoration she grabbed for balance. Repair costs are estimated at $5,800, while she faces potential fines of up to $47,000 for damaging an artistic and architectural asset. The fountain, created by Bartolomeo Ammanetti in 1559, commissioned by Cosimo de' Medici, increasingly attracts tourists attempting social media stunts despite enhanced surveillance, including CCTV cameras. Giorgio Caselli from Florence's Fine Arts Office condemns such behavior as reflecting disrespect for the city's heritage, warning against ignorance and superficiality around historic monuments. Well, bottom line and the moral of this story: never touch genitals that aren't your own without consent. And boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff All presents the Idiot of the Day.
An unnamed 17-year-old male riding an intercity transit bus in Olympia, Washington, says a man sat next to him, showed him a gun, and asked him if he wanted to use marijuana with him. He declined. The man tried to engage him in a conversation about sexual habits, but his target wouldn't engage. The man then allegedly referenced the gun and ordered his victim to get off the bus with him. Once off the bus, the man tried to guide the teen to a specific direction, but the teen instead jumped onto another bus as its doors were closing and escaped. On arrival at the next transit station, he got off and called police. Police didn't indicate how they knew who the suspect was, but it was very easy to find the 18-year-old. He was wearing an ankle monitor, which showed him in Tumwater. Police there picked him up. He's also not named, but he was charged with kidnap and felony harassment. He still had the gun on him. A BB gun. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you try to kidnap a teenager on a public transit bus with a BB gun while you're wearing an ankle monitor? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0874. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0874. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com and over the air on stations like
World FM New Zealand,
WNRHLPFM Newport Beach, Florida,
KZZHLPFM Eureka, California,
WFNULP St. Paul, Minnesota,
CKUWFM Winnipeg,
CFMU Hamilton,
CKLU Sudbury,
Local 107.3 FM St. John,
CHSR Fredericton.
Plus, streaming on any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
Sir Dudley here. You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Remember these words of wisdom. You can't choose a book by its cover or title. I read a book called The 10 Best Ways to Clean Your Pig. It was complete hogwash.